welcome to Athenaeum Review, where we talk about the ideas that shape our world. I'm Ben Lima, and our guest today is Gregory Williams, Associate Professor of Contemporary Art History and Associate Chair of the Department of Art History at Boston University. He's published widely on contemporary art in journals such as October, Art Forum, Art Journal, Frieze, Parquet, and Texte zur Kunst, and contributed catalog essays for exhibitions at the Tate Modern, Museum Ludwig, and Kunstmuseum Basel, among many others. His book, Permission to Laugh, Humor and Politics in Contemporary German Art, was published by the University of Chicago Press. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
I wanted to start by asking you about this period in the late 1970s and early 90s in Germany, when there was apparent, in West Germany, that is, at that time, where there was this political shift, a sort of turn towards the more conservative side. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how this political context had effects on the kind of art that was being made.
Sure, yeah. I think one can go back to already to the early 1970s and talk about all kinds of changes that were taking place in West Germany at the time, not yet so much on the level of party politics, you know, where the Social Democrats managed to stay in power throughout most of the 1970s. Kohl came into power in the early 80s. But it was a sign that a sort of series of events that indicated that the 1960s, the late 60s, this era of protest and change and even revolution wasn't playing out quite as people had anticipated, especially people on the left. And so this term Tendenzwende was bandied about and was discussed in different quarters. And in some ways, it's a term that refers to economic shifts. And you could say it's partly about the sort of the waning momentum of the economic miracle that had seen West Germany thrive and become this economic and technological powerhouse in the 50s and 60s. It was partly associated with the oil crisis of the early 1970s and various other economic events. And so on the one hand, the Tendenzwende speaks to broader socio-political shifts, but on a cultural level, and that's really where I'm taking my, that's where my book begins essentially, is trying to understand some generational shifts within West Germany in the post-war period. I talk in my book about the three different generations that in the art world, which kind of relates to three different generations in the post-war period. And so on the one hand, you've got figures like Josef Beuys and this idea of the Tate Generation, those who actually took part in the war. You've got the next generation of artists who come up in the 1960s. And so that, for me, the key figures there are Sigmar Polke and Jörg Immendorf, and we can talk more about this, but this relates to my interest in humor and jokes as they emerge in German visual culture, the 60s and 70s. But the next generation is the so-called No Future generation, and that's the people who come of age in the 1980s. And so the Tendenzwende as a term has also been linked to cultural shifts. And that would be a kind of potentially an increasing conservatism in the visual arts, and maybe a return, for instance, back to what many in the late 60s and 70s would have thought of as sort of outmoded modes, like a kind of grand painting tradition. But on the other hand, it spoke to ideas of a kind of general sense of defeat or collapse or the sort of loss of a different kind of momentum, a momentum that indicated cultural change that had begun in earnest in the mid to late 60s. And so one key document that tracks this history was a book that came out in the late 1970s that Jürgen Habermas edited, and it was essentially looking at the spiritual situation of the age. It was a reference back to a book by Karl Jaspers of earlier in the 20th century. And essentially, these philosophers and theorists he invited to write essays for is a two-volume edition published by Zurkamp. Looked back to this period from about 1968 to 78, a decade after the events of 68, and they said, you know, what happened to the revolution? The idea being that it hadn't anticipated that many of the key players had gone into industry or into politics, and the massive changes that they were hoping for hadn't taken place at the level they were hoping. Which is not to say there weren't major changes, and out of the 60s have come the new social movements, many of which led to real change in West German society. But culturally, there was a sense of a kind of depletion. And so the main part of my narrative in my book looks back to that moment where the third generation, I refer to the so-called No Future generation label that some have applied to them, in some ways are both potentially disappointed and concerned by this status, but in some ways also decided to kind of dwell in a situation of defeat and loss and lack of perspective. And so there was a kind of embrace of defeatism as its own kind of generative force.
And this this third generation, the future generation that you mentioned, artists like Martin Kippenberger, for example. So if we go back just a little bit before that, because this is such an interesting artist. So Sigmar Polka is someone who's really, I mean, humor is a big part of his work, but he's from this earlier generation. He's older than Kippenberger and so forth. So would you say that his use of humor is sort of prefiguring what they're doing, or is it sort of different because he's from a different time?
Well, a bit of both. He's really perhaps the most relevant figure for understanding how these artists of the 80s, Martin Kippenberger, the latter of whom worked directly with Polka in Hamburg as his students, and all of them knew him. So in a sense, I think what he develops is a kind of idea of banality and triviality that many have written about. This interest in common, ordinary, sort of middle-class values that he mocks, but also kind of holds up as topics worthy of our attention, and certainly worthy of the artist's attention. So he comes very much out of the 1960s and 70s, and he's interesting in so many different ways, but people often refer to his work as not especially political, not in the way certainly that, say, Beuys expected the artist to have a political influence on society. And yet there are lots of references to politics, and there's a kind of critical sensibility that runs through so much of his work. There's also just an incredible sense, and this is where I think he begins to differentiate him, but we can differentiate him a bit from his next generation. That is a sense of formal and material experimentation that in its depth and in its richness and in its sheer kind of the joy with which he approached his studio practice and the sheer thoroughness of his experiments with materials and formats and platforms, that comes out of a certain experimental spirit of the 1960s and 70s. And some of this took place in Cologne and Dusseldorf. Some of it took place on his commune in Willich, outside of Dusseldorf in the countryside, where he had a house and a number of people used to come spend time with him in the 1970s. And that became a really important place also for the testing out of ideas, taking all kinds of substances to experiment with the sensory perception and how that might affect the work. And it's not to say that the next group of artists didn't experiment. They did, but I think there's a kind of attention to the, I don't want to say truth of the materials, but Polka had a kind of an attitude toward his subjects, but especially in the 1980s to the materiality of his work that was incredibly thorough, paid a kind of homage to the materials themselves in a way that I think harkens back to earlier traditions and situates him within a kind of longer stretch of modernism. He's really somebody, he's often described as sort of an essential postmodernist in his interest in hybridity of forms and images, his sense of play, his lack of any kind of sort of dogmatic or dominant formal language. And yet, I think there's something about the deliberateness of his work and about just the sheer amount he produced and the consistent studio practice he had that puts him a little bit more in a tradition of the serious modernist artist, despite the fact that there's so much play and
right.
Experimentation, but even disruption, I guess you could use a more contemporary term in his practice.
That really makes a lot of sense. I remember seeing, well, I guess particularly late works by Polka about 12 years ago in Hamburg, and then there are some here in Dallas, and really being struck by that richness and complexity of the materials and even their beauty, arguably, mm-hmm. and thinking this is a little bit different from the kind of Polka that I was familiar with, where the painting that I always want to bring up is the one where you sort of could get it from the title, i.e. Higher Powers Command, Paint the Upper Right in Black. And you know, someone who on the one hand could be so sly as to do that earlier one, but then also so somehow deep as to do this later one. I mean, mm-hmm. he really covers a lot of...
Yeah, and there's a transition in his work that okay. you can see pretty clearly in the retrospective that MoMA put together. Right. And there have been other major overviews of his work, but that came... We were able to see that it came into being while he was alive, but it was on view after he passed away. And so it was a real full overview of everything he'd ever produced. And you could really see the different phases in his career, and there's absolutely continuity and all kinds of through lines in terms of theme and technique and material. But as he got older, and particularly during the years when this next generation really comes into its own, he becomes, I'd say, more open to a very firm embrace of aesthetics right. In a more traditional sense, which is, again, not to say that the experimentation ends,
right,
and they still have this incredibly playful, subtle layering of different cultural references and all kinds of images from different sources, which puts them into dialogue, of course, with all kinds of postmodernist painters right. in the U.S. and across Europe. But there was I feel like his work over time, as much as it retained its humor, there was a kind of certain gravitas to it, yeah. and it comes, which sounds a little bit perverse to say in relationship to polka,
yeah.
but it comes through in scale, it comes through in materials, it comes through even in color choice. There's a certain seriousness that, and I think it was always there, but it right. became more visible later on.
So if we look by contrast, again, Martin Kippenberger, who's about 12 years younger than mm-hmm. Polka, born in 1953, could you just maybe contrast what he's doing a little bit to what we were just talking about?
Yeah, Kippenberger and his circle of friends in the early 80s, and one has to really, I think, speak to their work as not as a collective in any sort of organized sense, but they were very much in dialogue with each other, and there were a lot of shared interests and a lot of commentary back and forth as a group in that phase of the, you know, the very late 70s, but really the early 80s, right on up through the decade. And that would slowly shift as each came into, in this case, most of these were male artists, each into his own practice. I guess, just to start with Kippenberger, you can see also a desire to grapple with art history as a discipline and to find his way into the practice that would define him as a visual artist. But in his case, whereas Polka really began and ended as a visual artist, Kippenberger experimented with different roles. And in some ways, he could have just as easily become an actor, maybe not a writer, although he tried his hand at writing a novel right. as well. The art world offered him a platform where he could dabble in a lot of different roles. He did a little bit of acting in the late in the 70s and early 80s in, you know, friends films, experimental films. But his persona, I think, is what really makes him quite distinct from Polka. And that was somebody who had obviously a very kind of exhibitionist streak, somebody who needed to be at the center of attention, somebody who could be quite domineering
right.
and controlling in many ways, who by all accounts could also be quite a bit of fun and quite amusing, and just generally not observing the niceties of the right. world during these years. Whereas Polka, for all his play and his social group and for his experimentation, his travel, he traveled quite a bit, just as Kippenberger did. He tended to be a less visible public persona, and, yeah. and Kippenberger really produced this kind of persona as this, to use a really tired expression, this bad boy
right,
artist.
Right.
And from today's perspective, these positions look extremely juvenile, which right. they were.
Yeah.
Quite intentionally, I think. But at the moment, the art world wasn't quite used to those figures in the way that they would become, you know, figures like Julian Schnabel and, for a time, Albert Uhlen and various other figures in the United States who were out in public and essentially trying to draw attention to themselves, making spectacles of themselves. There weren't that many of these figures. Kippenberger was quite an extreme case.
Playing off that, You mentioned the term bad boy, and something I was kind of curious about was, well, the role of gender. So this is, I guess, a very male dominated
yes.
circle and so on and so forth. But it seems also interesting that his persona is hardly the kind of heroic, masculine, great man. He's, you know, there's like, again, just to cite the title of the work, something like "Go Stand in the Corner, Martin," or something.
Be ashamed.
And, yeah. you know, he's, I don't know if pathetic is the word, but he's perhaps self-mocking or self-abasing. Mm-hmm. And could you talk, is there a kind of tension between this kind of social environment and the way that he doesn't seem to be exactly glorifying masculinity?
No, he is in many ways undermining at every turn the idea of some sort of heroic genius figure. And that's, I think, tied into this sense of belatedness, this sense of defeatism, this sense of having kind of missed, you know, the boat of modernism. And what do you do now in the early 80s? This is obviously a question that was preoccupying a lot of artists in the West during the 1980s. By all means, not every artist, but this is something that Kippenberger actively dealt with. And in some ways, though, you can chart a whole history there of artists going back even to the 19th century to figures like Lovis Corinth, who made these self-portraits in the early 20th century of himself as a kind of Bacchus figure, but also a serious drinker whose body was both masculine but also looked quite fragile. And Kippenberger would then go on to just completely overdo this approach to take it to an extreme and paint all kinds of very unflattering self-portraits, but obviously very comedic self-portraits. So it was self-ironic, it was self-mocking. But, you know, that self-mockery can turn into its own form of control and dominance. And if you talk to people who worked with him in the 80s and 90s, you get some pretty mixed responses. And some people found him absolutely unbearable. Some people found him, incredibly lively and generous in many ways. He was generous to younger artists. He basically just needed to socialize nonstop. So he's a special case in a way, but that approach was reinforced by his relationship with these other artists who were making work that performed some of the same kinds of ideas of a sort of failed or empty masculinity, but who didn't maybe do it quite as performatively and quite as visibly in the public's space as Kippenberger did.
The other thing you mentioned a minute ago, well, talking about, let's say, how maybe German humor in particular translates or doesn't translate in this country or international. Yeah. So Kippenberger is maybe not quite as famous here in the States as he is elsewhere. And I can't help thinking, as a contrast, of Anselm Kiefer, where there's someone who's kind of so grandiose and massive and very, 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 very serious, who is absolutely loved in America. Yeah. It's like that's what people here want out of a German artist. Mm. Whereas not only Kippenberger, but the other peers, you know, are maybe not quite as well known. Could you just talk about kind of that question of translation how it comes across here or doesn't?
Yeah, it's a topic that interests me quite a bit. I think with Kippenberger, his work, much of his work translates pretty well, especially the work that has titles that are in English. He did a number of works where his own titles are in English, or they're in German, but they translate really easily. Because a lot of his work is based on various forms of visual jokes that then might have a kind of textual component, in that there's a relationship, there's a kind of before and after, a set of punchline relationship between the painting or the print or drawing and the title, or sometimes the language is directly in the image. Where that image-text relationship, that kind of temporal, seeing a scene that you don't quite understand, but then getting the context through the title or phrase. A lot of his work travels pretty well, actually. I think it's more the case that, I mean, Kiefer's also from an older, he's from Polka's generation, only like 4 years apart. You know, Kiefer is of this generation whose work appeared in the U.S. in the early 80s already, whereas Kippenberger's work took a little bit longer to get here, and I think it was just by virtue of curators getting to know it. And you could say that he was already showing in the late 80s in the U.S., but his reputation here, I think it's a lot of the work that we're seeing now, and there's a ton of Kippenberger shows going all the time at galleries. They're really, the work's valuable. The market demands more Kippenberger shows right now. And a lot of the works that they're showing, if you go to galleries in New York, or works from the 90s in particular that didn't get a lot of play when they were first made, partly because they just made so many of them. Again, in this kind of context of self-portraits, failed self-portraits, even these kind of later images from his riff on the Raft of the Medusa, the Sherry Coe motif, in which toward the end of his life he did a series of works based on drawings he had done from the photos of the painting that Sherry Coe, the Raft of the Medusa. Those images end up, in a way, the humor is kind of sucked out of those images. They actually look quite full of pathos and even kind of verge more in the direction of tragedy rather than comedy. There have been all kinds of comments about that having to do with his sense of mortality. He wasn't in good shape physically when he made these. I don't think he knew how ill he was about to become, but it was this is the late work that he produced. And a lot of that, I think, translated really well. So one needs also to point out that in the 90s, he was doing projects that spoke to a more global context, the MetroNet project, where he envisioned a global subway network and made multiple sort of fake stations that popped up in different parts of the world, from the middle of Germany to somewhere in the Yukon, as a kind of commentary on this period where the art world was becoming more global, more interconnected. More places were becoming visible, more artists were becoming central to the narrative. So I guess to answer your question, you would have to look at different phases of his career. Despite those aspects of his work that do travel well, there's a lot of inside kinds of jokes,
right,
and very localized references, very German references to German popular culture, to everyday consumer products, to current events. Those kinds of paintings, when they end up here, they're interpreted more just in terms of their slapdash, their execution, their style, and maybe a little bit less in terms of what is almost always this very kind of layered commentary,
right,
that he was quite adept at making.
Yeah.
It varies considerably. And one would have to look at each of these artists and think about how their work translated and which works tend to do well in which markets or in which, which kind of speak to which audiences.
Actually, as a sort of contrast, I wanted to ask you also about his peer, another artist from this generation and sort of circle, Rosemarie Trockel, who, being a woman artist, was not part of this sort of male-dominated group, but she has been very successful also using humor. But whether about gender or otherwise, could you just tell us a little bit about her work, mm-hmm, and kind of how she maybe has a slightly different approach to some of these same challenges of the same period and so forth?
Yeah, her background's a little bit different. She actually studied in an applied art school first in the 70s and then found her way into working in multiple. She forms, if you look at Cologne as this site, as a city where most of these people were operating, in the 80s, Cologne becomes the more important city in relationship to Düsseldorf, which is very close, but which dominated really the 60s and 70s. Both places, of course, stayed relevant for all of these years as they are today. The scene, the more lively scene, the social scene, that was more based in Cologne starting in the 80s. So you can talk about different groups, just like you can New York in the 1980s, but you can talk about Kippenberger's group, which is mostly artists associated with Max Hetzler. They're all working with him by the mid-80s, Georg Herold and other figures. Whereas Rosemarie Trockel formed an alliance with a woman art dealer, Monika Sprüt, who opened her gallery in the early 1980s out of a relationship with Trockel, with a desire to work together and to form a space for women artists to show. And they developed their own kind of position in Cologne. It's not to say that all these groups didn't interact, but of course they did.
Right.
And it was a small enough town, and they went to the same bars. And I mean, Trockel's famously a little bit averse to crowds and wasn't nearly, she was in a way the opposite personality to Kippenberger. She's much more of a quiet, collative, private person. They were actually, from what I understand, fairly close early on, and I'm sure knew each other through this whole time and antagonized her in various moments as he did so many other people. But these people overlapped with each other. There was also the Paul Menz Gallery, which showed a whole other group of painters, and she knew them as well. But I think what was really important about the Sprüt Gallery is that you saw them looking out to other kinds of alliances. And so one thing that developed in the second half of the 80s was a connection with New York. And the connection between Cologne and New York develops really in a very strong way in the late 80s and early 90s. And a lot of that, I think, not only, but a lot of that comes from Monika Sprüt's efforts and Trockel's efforts to bring American women artists over to Cologne, like Cindy Sherman and Barbara Kruger. Then, of course, other artists like Christopher Wall and Stephen Prina and a whole range of people, were Christopher Williams, were coming over from New York and showing in Cologne during these late years as well. And at some point, I think all of this sort of the kind of cliquishness it stayed intact, and yet new figures arrived, and yet again a new group of younger artists appeared at some point.
So my follow-up question about Truckle is actually this aspect of her work, which is very funny but also sort of disturbing, is this theme of animals.
Yeah.
And my take would be, well, is that, you know, is it raising the question, are people really just animals? Is there anything, you know, is like the eternal question, like, is there anything about people that's, are we not just animals? Could you tell us a little bit about how what she does with animals in her work?
Sure, I'll try. You know, the kinds of subjects she works with or worked with, I mean, what she became first really known for was not about animals,
right.
Although there were animal-like creatures in some of her early sculptures. But she became known initially for the wool paintings, which were these industrially produced paintings that she would have made by companies based on patterns she designed. So it was, you know, everything from made in Western Germany to images of the hammer and sickle to various kinds of logos and emblems. And talking about sort of the free-floating sign, it was a lot about semiotics, at the time. It's more in the latter part of the 80s where you'd start seeing some more concentrated projects about, and in the 90s, about human-animal relations. And so she did projects with chickens. She did this piece in, I think it was the 1997 Documenta. She did it with Karsten Huller, where she created this place for people and pigs, as it was titled. You had live pigs in a pen and then a kind of viewing room with a window, and you could stand and observe the pigs and think about this relationship between you as this observer and them as these kind of quasi-performers. But I think that there's aspects to her work, and I've written about this before, where the animal, it's certainly not about elevating the animal to kind of human status, or it's not an activist animal rights kind of approach. If anything, there's a little bit of a kind of tough, barbed humor attached to animals just as it would be attached to humans. In other words, all living creatures kind of could be subjected to her treatment. And animals pop up more in her work, I'd say, as hybrids, where you see kind of human-animal forms, you know, the upper body, drawings with the upper body of a human, and this kind of morphing between species and categories. I think that was just one way in which she was trying to break down all kinds of long-running divisions between forms, between different life forms, but also different kinds of forms within art history, between different categories of medium materiality. So I wouldn't go so far as to say that the animal was a sort of singular track. It was just one among many ways she challenged kind of easy ideas about what a particular life form might represent.
Yeah. Welcome back to the Athenaeum Review podcast, where we'll continue our conversation with Gregory Williams about contemporary art in Germany. So to ask a little bit more of a general question about humor, there's this question where someone might say, especially this kind of humor that we were discussing, you know, is it just a way of defensively becoming sort of apathetic and helpless and giving up? And, you know, what do you say to someone who says, well, no, the important thing is to not give up and continue with activism, and it's just too demoralizing, all this kind of mockery and everything. Like, what would you say to this kind of anti-humor?
Anti-humor contingent.
Yeah.
There's a lot of responses. Let's see. So, first of all, I see humor for these artists as generative. I think it's actually about how to produce ideas at root. And so as much as, and this is an important follow-up to what you were asking earlier about this kind of sense of defeat, cultural defeat, which is itself a kind of trope within German history that goes back way, you know, way before the contemporary period, or the period of the 70s on. And you could say that the presence of jokes becomes a kind of self-generating process where one joke begets the next joke begets the next joke. And these artists, particularly when they were spending a lot of time together in the key years of the 1980s, and particularly those who really worked in a quasi-group context, again, we're not talking about shared studios and that kind of level of collaboration, but in some cases there was actual direct co-authorship. And I think it's that group dynamic that I find quite interesting, the social space that jokes create.
Yeah.
They may be not the nicest jokes. They may not always be the funniest jokes. And in fact, that's another thing I'm interested in, this idea of the joke being a model for creativity, I suppose, for speech or social exchange, that actually doesn't have to rely on laughter. There's a lot of jokes that you that make you pause and reflect, that don't right. necessarily make you laugh out loud, although there are plenty of works that these artists produce that are quite funny in a very traditional sense of causing mirth and laughter. And then, of course, there's the factor when you're writing about humor, everybody's going to say, the moment you explain the joke, you kill it. And right. and yes, that's true. And I think in some ways, their work is also acknowledging that. They're hitting you over. It varies considerably. And then there's, I find the humor in Rosemary Troeckle and in other artists, Isa Genskin, even though that's yeah. something that not a lot of people would necessarily identify in her work, I don't tend to think of it so much in terms of humor as in terms of wit. It's a kind of clever intellectual play that is amusing. Right. For instance, a lot of Isa Genskin's works in concrete and plaster, right. they can look quite sloppy. I'm thinking particularly of his works like My Brain, yeah. where she models a kind of loose brain formation and has little out-of-studio detritus with a kind of wire sticking out of yeah. the top, which of course refers to her World Receiver series, where she made essentially what looked like radios out of yeah. concrete that obviously didn't bring any, had no transmitting capability. So the humor, yes, it's coming out of a moment where there's a kind of sense of a logjam or a kind of things are stalled. Yeah. The progress of the modern project is no longer moving forward. It's gotten stuck. Of course, there's also the side of postmodernism, which is all about saying it's time to, this is, you know, Lyotard and others, it's time to just overturn the idea that the master narrative is what we need to adhere to anyway, that yeah. there's no kind of overarching sense of progress, there's no teleological understanding of art, and that kind of fragmentation leads to an opening up.
Right.
It leads ultimately, in one explanation, into this relationship between art and ideas of globalization,
right.
into a much more interconnected series of points around the globe. And I don't know, one could maybe make the argument that some of these artists in places in the West, and this would correlate with various kinds of post-colonial theories, that as these cultures lost their global dominance, you know, you could see these jokes and the sarcasm and even the cynicism of some of these artists as being kind of last gasps of power and influence, and both a kind of admission of loss of cultural dominance at the same and a self-mocking of that process taking place, but even at the same time still kind of grasping for a certain hold, certain yeah. bit of control.
Before I follow up and ask you about globalization, I wanted to follow up and ask another thing about Isa Genskin, whom people here will yeah. know about as the winner of the Nasher Prize this year, and obviously very important. And you mentioned in connection with her work the question of architecture, and I was thinking, when we look at her work, and there's, I don't know if you mentioned this, but the way there's, she's kind of responding to the Bauhaus and modernist architecture and so forth, we could say, okay, well, she can fit in as someone who's, you know, the utopian dream of modern architecture and Gropius and Le Corbusier and so forth, like that's all dead and gone, and now all that's left is kind of this, you know, mockery and so forth. But that doesn't really, I don't think that really does justice to what she's doing. If you look at her work, this is someone, you know, she, in a way, I think she loves architecture, or there's this kind of fascination with architecture, and it's more complex than just kind of saying goodbye to the modernist dream, although maybe that's part of it. But then on the other hand, you know, she's not acting as an architect, she's acting as an artist, and, you know, there's certainly a whole kind of postmodern architecture that has its own response to modernism. But she's not building buildings, but she's thinking a lot about architecture. So it seems very complex, I guess, as is obvious. But I just wondered if you could kind of discuss a little bit more what Genskin is up to and kind of where she's positioning herself amongst all of this stuff.
I think she's, you know, one of the most interesting living artists in Germany right now. Anywhere, her practice has gone through, her work's gone through multiple phases. You know, to look at her ellipsoids, these floor-based sculptures of the 70s and early 80s, and to compare them to some of these later works that are just messy and using dolls and studio detritus and all kinds of really gaudy colors, you sometimes can be hard-pressed. The uninformed viewer might not be able to really put those two together. But there are a number of through lines in her work, and I think, you know, you could certainly mark the turn in her work in the early to mid-90s, where she starts incorporating a lot more cheap, right. consumer type materials, cellophane and a lot of plastic, using a lot of found photos, using a lot of found materials like plastic mass produced toys, dolls, all kinds of throwaway materials that are just really quite grotesque and excessive in their materiality and the way that she pairs them, making these kind of hybrids. That has, at that moment, she really leaves behind some of her earlier work that has a certain type of formal elegance to it. It's grounded in various formal traditions from minimalism, post-minimalism, to architecture of the Bauhaus, to all kinds of different sculptural traditions. But there's a kind of serious, reflective aspect to that, to those work going right up through the 1980s. And then things start getting a lot looser. And I do think, though, and of course one has to look at this large career, and she's been incredibly productive. I think in general, she's constantly riffing on form. I mean, she's, in many ways, she is much more of a formalist than someone like Kippenberger was. And I think that comes out of her training. I think it comes out of the circle of people she was first spending time with, working with in her for her first show, Conrad Fischer, aka Conrad Luke, the artist, and his connection to American minimalists. She's probably more connected to figures like Blinky Palermo in those early years than she is to somebody like Kippenberger or Georg Herold or anyone else. But the work, I mean, then Harold's another figure who falls yet into another position. I don't want to generalize too much about these figures, but I think Genskin's architecture is just one formal language that she taps into. She really feels free to tap into multiple languages and multiple traditions and to mix them in ways that I think in some of the later work people found hard to place because it seems so explosive and grotesque, you know, especially the work with the dolls and the paint on the dolls these little installations. But looking backward from that work to the earlier work, it's there's just been a steady narrative of formal and material experimentation. And weirdly, those groupings, those rather grotesque groupings, they often really hold together. There's a sculptural sensibility behind them that somebody else would not have been able to make them the way she does. There's a weird kind of balance to those works, even as they look like they're just about to collapse and they don't seem to have this kind of guiding hand, this guiding mind behind them. The earlier sculptures did.
It's kind of amazing, actually. So to come back to this question of the realization, especially after 1989, to talk about that kind of period when you've written about biennials and so forth. And I was struck a few minutes ago, you mentioned Kippenberger's kind of subway project, MetroNet. And then also there was this, his sort of pretend Museum of Modern Art on a remote Greek island. And then the one that I think everyone here will know by On Green and Dragset, the Prada Marfa out there on the highway. And they all seem to be touching on this idea that there's this kind of, you know, global culture of Prada and biennials and kind of elite capitalist sophisticated world that yet is really, really incongruous when it touches down someplace like by the side of a highway and so forth. And well, I guess the question that I would pose would be, As you studied these earlier periods, i.e. the 70s and 80s and so forth, how would you describe, is there a kind of shift in the kind of humor that artists do after 1989 or this kind of, let's say, biennial era humor? Would you contrast that to the Kippenberger generation in some way, or is it sort of?
Yeah, I think there are shifts have taken place. I think more and more artists are attuned to the idea of making work that travels well, that translates as it moves from place to place. I think that shift in Kippenberger's career that I talked about earlier into the 90s is he saw these, he was a master at commenting on what was happening in the moment, commenting on historical phenomena, but really responding to current events and trends and mocking them while also keeping them moving. And so that MetroNet project, the Museum of Modern Art in Syros on this Greek island, a half partially begun building out of cinder block that a friend on a property is near his friend's place. All of that, that's part of a much larger narrative of artists having to adapt their work or make work from the get-go that is meant to be seen in multiple locations and understood in multiple places. And so I guess it's not so much that there's any sort of radical break, but it's just the sheer number of cultures, languages, perspectives has become so vast at this point that no one person can keep track of everything. That's one side of it. But at the same time, sort of in a way, globalization has these two faces. On the one hand, there is just radical difference and multiplicity, but there's also at the same time a kind of coming together and a kind of agreement that certain types of works get chosen over other types of works. There's certain types of jokes. Obviously, there's obviously always going to be room for jokes that make fun of the very institution that you're visiting. And so that's, you know, that's coming out of a whole history of so-called institutional critique where, you know, going back to the 60s and the early 70s with well-known figures like Daniel Buren and Marcel Brodars, and then right on up through the 80s where artists like Andrea Fraser wrote extensively about this term, which really only gets used in the 80s for the first time, and which you can apply to some of these later projects in the 21st century, where there's this idea of making work that responds specifically to the context in which you're operating. So it's no longer this sense that no one's ever thought about leaving the institution and reflecting on it from the outside. That's been going on for a long, long time now. It's more that the institution, whether it wants to or not, the institution being all curators and directors, artistic directors of biennials, they gravitate toward works that refer to this overall frame, this overall process. So as far as humor goes, those kinds of works do quite well. Like the Elm Green and Dragsit is that they've capitalized on that. They've really attached their work to this engine of globalization and commented on it and participated in it simultaneously. It's no accident that they were then asked to curate the Istanbul Biennial, I guess in its last iteration, after having commented so frequently in their work on that culture, among many other developments. But at the same time, though, there's, I think, a bit of pushback going on in biennials of recent years that have tried to be a little bit less focused. And by biennials, we're obviously talking about biennial culture, so triennials, quadriennials, regularly occurring large-scale group exhibitions. There's also a number of shows that you could look to the Berlin Biennial of this past summer, where they're really trying to push against the idea of having a kind of dominant theme, a clear narrative. They're looking to include figures whose work, while critical and making forceful statements, is maybe not as bombastic and as kind of driven by an interest in speaking to this audience of global travelers, those who tend to see all these shows on a regular basis, and more shows that are maybe allowing the work to remain a little bit, works coming from parts of the world outside of Europe and the United States, sometimes translating some of the terms, sometimes keeping them a little bit vague and letting people grapple with something that they don't know that much about. That can be a very productive approach as well.
In that kind of connection, one of this current period whom you've written about, Cosima von Bonin, who has all kinds of connections with some of these other topics in terms of obviously humor, but she uses textiles and things like that. Could you just maybe tell us a little bit about her work?
If we want to then think again a little bit about when people emerge, when they come onto the scene, as it were. And in her case, it happened in the early 90s when Cologne really, that seemed, the sense of a kind of critical mass of artists there that had developed across the 80s. The next group sort of arrives, and that's people like Christian Nagel, the dealer. It's the critic and editor and historian Isabel Grove. It's figures like Americans who go over there to show, like Andrea Fraser, or the Swiss artist Christian Philipp Müller, many other figures. Cosima Bonin appears in her first shows are in that context. She was quite close to Kippenberger. Much of her approach plays with some similar ideas of working with some kind of ham-fisted cultural references, but with a formal language that I think had a certain consistency to it once she found her way to it. There's some her earliest shows are, they don't look, the work doesn't look like what people associate, you know, with she didn't get to the textile works until later. She didn't get to the installation-based works until later. It took her time to develop her kind of her iconography, basically. And she's talked about that, just as another figure who kind of needs to be mentioned in this context is Michael Kreber, somebody who grew up in Cologne and grew up part of that scene as a child and was connected to the gallery world early on. He, too, he's the same age more or less as Kippenberger and served as a studio assistant for a while, and by rights, you know, in terms of his age, should have been showing through most of the 1980s, but in a way he sort of pulled back and watched what all these other artists were doing and figured out his own path, which went in a completely different direction, even if it's I think in dialogue with some of their play with irony and humor. The humor that's left in his work is very, very subtle. It's highly coded. Yeah. Ironic, very, very knowing works that I think both he and von Bonin, they developed a kind of visual language that still retains some of that idea of a more obvious type of joke, but more for insiders. And so it becomes, weirdly, the language becomes a little bit more private in some ways. That's maybe generalizing a bit too much, and later on, especially with von Bonin's larger installations she's done, where there's more overt references to things like cartoon characters from Disney and various kinds of... They talk about animals. A lot of her later work deals with animals and her love of sea creatures, which she talks about having been partly of. And yeah, I don't know if that totally answers your question, but it gets to this idea of there's no longer, I think, the sense with the work of Kreber and von Bonin that the jokes are hitting you over the head. Yeah. And you don't even have to get all of the jokes to appreciate some of the formal experimentation. But it does make the work hard for some audiences. It comes across as quite opaque, and I think that group of artists who emerged in Cologne in the early 90s often was quite comfortable with opacity.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. Wow. Well, so finally, you're here in Dallas to give a lecture in connection with the Günter Ferg exhibition, mm-hmm. which is now at the Dallas Museum of Art. And I won't ask you to go over your entire lecture, which everyone will have to come and see. But maybe let me just ask, when you first saw this exhibition, I mean, obviously being familiar with his work in general, were there things that surprised you or, you know, maybe new things that you discovered from this exhibition you hadn't seen before?
Well, for one thing, I have to see the rest of the show because so far I've only had a chance to see part of it because of the timing. But right off the bat, what surprised me were some of these later, done in the early 2000s, these plaster sculptures, these very kind of goopy, clunky-looking sculptures made out of plaster and various studio materials, sponges and brushes and then just garbage. You know, they made me think of Isa Genskin's works in plaster from the early 1980s, and I'm sure he knew them. They also make me think of Cy Twombly's sculpture. Yeah. I think with Ferg, he's another interesting figure in that period. And again, somebody who you can't generalize about his work in the way that, well, maybe for better or worse, one can do with some of the other artists who worked together. The thing is, Ferg was part of the Hetzler group and showed with these same people quite often and is associated with them in the 80s. But his work really does a lot of different kinds of things. And in some ways, he's probably much closer to somebody like Genskin, who has real roots in ideas around modernist formalism and taking past visual languages very seriously. There's a kind of quietness to his work, even if scale-wise they can be quite overwhelming. And he makes he took an extensive series of photographs of fascist architecture, and one has to wonder what kind of political valence might be attached to works like that. But they don't tend to get politicized in critics' readings. So that happened at the time, but he doesn't have the bombast of some of the other members of this group that he was associating with. And I actually find him quite hard to pin down. Yeah. I'm still trying to figure him out all these years later. And I admittedly don't know his work as well as I have gotten to know some of the other artists' work. But these objects in the show, I think it was even just seeing, because I've seen so many of his works over the years and often in solo exhibitions of just, say, a set of paintings from 2007, to see them all connected to each other, you can start really identifying some through lines. And I think one of the things he does is he takes the history of modernism very seriously.
Yeah, he's, for sure.
I think the biggest question, and that's something I'll be dealing with this evening, is this idea of quotation versus citation versus mimicking, imitating versus copying. There are so many overt references to really well-known artists and his work. And I think the general message in a lot of his work is that each time you return to certain familiar forms and motifs, they get renewed in the present, they get recontextualized. And that itself, of course, is a long-running art historical tradition, and he was quite comfortable with that. So I think He himself said, and this is quoted in one of the catalog essays, that he's more interested in origins than quotations. Huh. Jeffrey Zalatnik's essay, that line is quoted. I think it's a very interesting way to think about his work. I want to push against it a little bit, actually. Huh. I think in some ways, because of the context in which his work appears in the 80s and into the 90s, you almost can't think away the idea of appropriation, the idea of a culture of quotation.
Right.
But I think the word citation is a little bit better. I think it's a little more gentle.
Right.
I think Kippenberger stole, he appropriated, he quoted, and often he'd have people make stuff for him.
Yeah.
Whereas with Ferg, there's this sense of it's less frenetic, his practice.
Yeah.
He produced a lot of work over his lifetime, and he died relatively young. There's a very deliberate and a kind of quietness to a lot of his work that I think comes through in this exhibition and makes him, somebody who taps and sort of touches on all kinds of traditions and famous artists, lesser known artists and architects and filmmakers and photographers. But there's a kind of steady formal experimentation in his work that never really veers, to my mind, into outright aggressive appropriation. Helpful to look at it now. I find this teaching in an undergraduate level, teaching post modernism as a historical phenomenon is a challenge because it's such a messy term. I mean, so many different things. There's no agreed single set of meanings or tightly framed narrative around it, and one touches on different aspects of it. But an artist like Ferg, an artist like Genskin, Trockel, they all make you think of postmodernism as something that is a kind of reckoning with the past rather than an outright rejection of it or this kind of wholesale process of replication and copying. It's deeply rooted, it's subtle, and it's often really quite knowing, which I think, to kind of come back to where we started, is less the impression one gets with a lot of work by Kippenberger, which seems to be so off the cuff,
right.
And hastily produced and just in this constant process of reacting things. By the same token, I think there are a lot of connections between them, and I think Kippenberger also had a really encyclopedic knowledge of the forms and visual languages he referenced. It's just that they didn't come from books and he didn't read, so he wasn't interested in spending time reading. Ferg is famous for having had this enormous library and having been really well read, and that alone and Trockel fall into the same category. So you have, these are just different approaches to dealing with the past. There are many ways in which these artists overlap in their recycling processes, but then you have to look really closely at each one to see how they pursued these ideas on an individual basis.
Wow, that's really interesting. I'm gonna be thinking about that as I walk through the show. Thank you. This is the Athenaeum Review podcast, and our guest today is Gregory Williams, who's here on behalf of the Dallas Museum of Art and the Edith O'Donnell Institute of Art History at UT Dallas to speak about the Günter Ferg exhibition. He's visiting from Boston University.